Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's follow the dollar, shall we, as we begin this week's edition of the broadcast. Always good stuff to be found there. You may have seen President Obama this week in a photograph, a selfie taken by Boston Red Sox hitter David Ortiz. It occurred when the Boston Red Sox, did you know they won the World Series last year? were visiting the White House. And so Ortiz took a moment to take this selfie with the president, which, of course, rocketed around the internet right to the left field wall. Well, it was cute. You know, these selfies are cute. But much like the one on the Oscars, remember the Oscars? When, Ellen? Yeah. Took a selfie of herself with a couple of celebrities, and then we learned soon after that it wasn't that spontaneous because Samsung had a product placement deal with ABC. Well, guess what? David Ortiz's selfie with the president, turns out, according to the Washington Post, was a commercial for Samsung's new phone. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney confirmed the president was unaware that Ortiz, who signed a new deal with the cell phone company on Monday, was being paid to take a selfie within a day or two. Bang! Man, if he was that fast on the base pass, maybe he is. Who knows? So, you know, when anybody wants to take a selfie with you, ask them in the immortal words of my friend Danny Thompson, how much? Now, there's more, however. As we follow the dollar, the Supreme Court came out with a decision on campaign financing this week, the so-called McCutcheon decision, that once again narrowed the scope of campaign finance regulations in the name of the First Amendment. And most commentators have arrayed themselves neatly, like iron filings, marching to the chosen poll. If indeed iron filings could march. Basically either, oh, God, no, this dooms our political system to more money, or money, campaign spending is speech. We have a First Amendment, end of story. Very rarely, if at all, did one hear in all the discussion about this so far, including on the Sunday Yak shows, any discussion of why politicians feel constrained to raise all that money. So some notes on that subject. From Pew, a foundation that studies media, among other things, a record $2.9 billion in 2012 was spent on political advertising on local television alone by all the candidates. From Bond and Pecaro, a firm which provides financial valuation and strategic consulting services to companies in the broadcasting industries. The 2012 election season, they were looking a little bit ahead, will bring a record-breaking $4.9 billion in political advertising spending, quoting analysts at Wells Fargo. Nearly half of that money would have been spent on broadcast television alone. Companies that own television stations in battleground markets benefited greatly during the election cycle, including CBS, which owns 10 television stations in swing states. Earlier in 2012, analysts at Wells Fargo Bank estimated broadcast television would gain at least $2.8 billion in political spending, up 16% from just 2 years earlier. From Advertising Age, TV advertising is the single biggest undertaking of any political campaign. About 75% of everything a candidate raises goes to support it. About two-thirds of all advertising dollars go to local broadcast television. From the Media Project at Wesleyan University, over 915,000 presidential ads were aired on broadcast and national cable television during 2012, not counting the final week of the election. That was this was issued before that final week. A 44% increase from 2008. Strange. All the yak shows on television networks didn't happen to mention that they are the major recipients of all the money that's raised thanks to the Supreme Court rulings. Nutty, huh? Hello, welcome to the show.
Of mine to walk along in a straight line. Easy there, steady now. Easy there, steady now. I'll call your name, I'll call it loud. I'll see your face in every crowd. Tonight, red dress, skin so white. Easy there, steady now. Easy there, steady now. 3 a.m. in empty town, Dr. Martin's echo down. Old man heartbreak follows you, corruption shadow swallows you. Easy there, steady now. Easy there, steady now. I'll call you.
From London, England, just off Leicester Square in London. As a matter of fact, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show with a reminder that it's all commercial broadcasting now. It's time for me to read the trades for you. Yes, indeed. From Adweek, NPR is running voice recognition-enabled ads.
What?
Please give. But before you do, I'll read it for you. What you say out loud may soon be marketing data. Voice recognition-enabled ads are fast becoming a tool of mobile advertisers who want to ramp up response rates that often fall well short of 1%. The futuristic promos quietly emerged. Not that quietly. Late last year, JetBlue and Toys R Us began employing them. Now, National Public Radio, doesn't call itself that anymore, is starting to run the ads on its smartphone app to delight its roughly 1 million monthly listeners. NPR has tested the audio spots during recent weeks and believes the ads, I said ads, which will be heard at the end of news items, have captured the imaginations of its tech-savvy audience. People have had to wait for their phones to wake up and then tap on their screens to learn more from our sponsors, said Brian Moffitt, VP of Digital Strategy and Ad Operations at National Public Media, an NPR subsidiary. With these ads, he continued, you simply speak. When our test group heard the call to action, say download now or say learn more, we universally heard them respond with, huh, sounding pleasantly surprised. Unquote, Brian. Using technology from Xapp Media, X-A-P-P, Moffitt's NPR subsidiary plans to charge north of $20 per 1,000 listeners for 15-second spots, which include the ability for the consumer to extend the ad with audio or video. NPR is elected not to disclose names of advertisers other than Lumber Liquidators. Tom?
Lumber Liquidators.
We've been demoing this for agencies and brands, Moffitt proclaimed. That's the word Adweek uses. He proclaimed it. Quote, and the reaction has been roundly positive. As opposed to squarely negative, I would imagine. But oh, and here's good news. Lexus and Chevy owners who have NPR on their in-vehicle apps dashboard will also begin hearing ads that ask them to talk back. Cars are an area we have high hopes for, Moffitt said. JetBlue's marketing team thinks NPR's sunny outlook is warranted. The airline's voice recognition mobile campaigns have resulted in 50% more time spent with the brand than the average rich media experience, says Rachel Allen, media director at JetBlue's ad agency. An analyst says mobile listeners' eyes are not on the screens and their hands are not on the device. To create interactivity, you need a mechanism that's consistent in how they're using the device. And the voice is the right mechanism. But the challenge is that it's an entirely, utterly new behavior to ask listeners to react to. There will be all kinds of uncertainty about what will be on the other side of that interaction. Unquote. voice that asks you to talk back. When you wonder what's coming next, one good way to find out is when I read the trays for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Which means you'll be hearing a version of it soon in the New York Times, or reading it in the New York Times, because this week Nicholas Kristof did a column about we're not number one. Isn't that wild? Of course he thought of it himself, just like Andrew Ross Sorkin thought of. What happened to that apologies thing in the deal book section? That went away fast. Ladies and gentlemen, what the frack? Reuters reports earthquakes rattle residents in Oklahoma on Saturday, the latest in a series that have put the state on track for record quake activity this year. Some seismologists say it may be tied to oil and gas exploration. One earthquake recorded at 3.8 rocked houses in several communities. Hey, we're rocking the house right here. In several communities around central Oklahoma early in the morning, another about 2 hours later in the same part of the state north of Oklahoma City. It was recorded at 2.9. A seismologist with the Oklahoma Geological Survey says the earthquake's activity in the state is soaring. Soaring, ladies and gentlemen. That means it's increasing rapidly. But you knew that. We have had almost as many magnitude 3 and greater already in 2014 than we did for all of 2013, said the seismologist Austin Holland. Last year's number of felt earthquakes, those strong enough to rattle items on a shelf, hit a record 222 in the state. This year, less than 4 months in, the state has recorded 253 such tremors. We have already crushed last year's record for number of earthquakes, Holland said. Scientists have long linked some small earthquakes to oil and gas work underground, which can alter pressure points and cause shifts in the earth. As you know, oil and gas exploration has increased in recent years, spurred by fracking. For bigger state quakes, so far, Oklahoma has recorded 106 at 3.0 magnitude and above. For all of last year, it only had 109. In November 2011, Oklahoma suffered a 5.6 magnitude quake. Wastewater disposal related to fracking is suspected by many scientists to contribute to the earthquake activity. Millions of gallons of wastewater, because we don't need water. We don't need water. What do you need water for? There's plenty. Well, it's always going to be more water. Millions of gallons of wastewater are typically trucked from a fracking site to wells where the water is injected thousands of feet underground into porous rock layers. That work, if done near a fault, can trigger larger quakes, according to several recent scientific studies. But wait, there's more. In golf clubs, gated communities, and other housing developments across the United States, tens of thousands of families have in recent years moved into new homes where their developers or home builders, with little or no prior disclosure, have kept the underlying mineral rights for themselves. This according to Reuters. Dozens of cases, the buyers were in the dark. This phenomenon is rooted in recent advances in fracking. As a result, home builders and developers have been increasingly hanging on to the mineral rights underneath their projects, pushing aside homeowners' interests to set themselves up for financial gain when energy companies come calling. This is happening in regions far beyond the traditional American oil patch. All the smart developers are doing it, says Lance Estrella, a Denver lawyer who represents mineral rights owners, including home builders, in deals with energy companies. D.R. Horton, the biggest U.S. home builder, is a heavy user of the practice. The Fort Worth, Texas company has separated the mineral rights from tens of thousands of homes in states where shale plays are either well underway or possible. In Florida alone, the builders kept the mineral rights underneath more than 10,000 lots. In most states, sellers aren't legally required to disclose to home buyers whether they're severing the mineral rights to a property. Buyers don't necessarily review their paperwork very closely, especially if they don't hire a lawyer to help them with the transaction. This is a huge case of buyer beware, says a professor of law and public policy at University of Colorado, Denver. People who move into suburban areas, he says, are really clueless about this, and the states don't exactly go out of their way to let people know. Multiple builders declined to respond to questions from Reuters about severing mineral rights under lots. Tom? Under lots. Under lots. Yes, indeed. What the frack, ladies and gentlemen? No, we didn't copyright it. New York Times, go ahead. But on the subject of energy, here's our friend the Atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
Addie, did you get caught in the rain today here in London?
Yeah. They don't sell those tiny umbrellas anymore.
They don't, really. Deadline Los Alamos National Laboratory, which is under a tight deadline to get nuclear waste off its northern New Mexico campus before wildfire season peaks.
What's the rush?
Has begun trucking the remainder of the waste to Texas. Los Alamos and Department of Energy officials say the first shipments arrived at a commercial nuclear waste dump in West Texas this week. Removal of the waste was halted in February after a truck fire and radiation leak shuttered indefinitely the federal government's underground nuclear waste dump in southeastern New Mexico. But federal officials have reached an agreement to temporarily move the waste to waste control specialists.
Well, they're specialists. That's why.
The state of New Mexico pressured Los Alamos to get the material off a mesa following a massive 2011 wildfire that lapped at the edges of lab property.
You don't want the waste being set alight, do you? Any waste.
No, you're right. No waste should be set alight. On Friday, the Vermont Public Service Board voted to authorize Entergy, the operators of the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant, to close down by the end of this year because Entergy planned to shut it down prior to its licensed end term. The board was required to approve it. It's a similar technology to TEPCO's ruined plant.
That's just a coincidence. That's a lucky coincidence.
It's a boiling water reactor. Vermont Yankee has had detractors from almost all of its 42-year history. A cooling tower cell collapsed there in 2007, and tritium leaks as high as 2.5 million picocuries, 125 times the EPA drinking water standard, have also occurred. Nonetheless, the NRC renewed the license for the plant 3 years ago. Entergy announced last August that it intends to shut the reactor down for economic reasons.
Gotta save a buck.
Yes, well, declining natural gas prices and low wind power prices are making nuclear-generated power too expensive.
Might as well tax the wind.
Yes, probably a good idea. The state and the company have adopted a memo of understanding that requires Entergy to provide $10 million for economic development in the neighboring county, which will lose more than 600 jobs. Also at issue is a 12-year-old National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit that's been under review by the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources for the past 8 years. Continued discharges of warm water into the Connecticut River appear to have adversely affected water quality downstream and altered ecological systems in the watershed.
Who can't stand a little warm water?
Entergy has reserved just $600 million to date for decommissioning the plant. It will not be adequate to meet the costs of full deconstruction, estimated at more than $1 billion, according to the company's own estimate. The company has pledged to put $25 million towards site restoration after decommissioning. However, the pledge would be moot if Entergy cannot totally commission the plant.
They'll get that money from somewhere.
You think?
Sure. Maybe they'll take a fundraising among the Atoms.
Yeah. Yeah, they'll do that. Hanford officials at the built our plutonium for years. Hanford officials should move radioactive cesium and strontium capsules to dry storage as soon as possible, in part because of the potential risk posed by a severe earthquake, according to federal inspectors. The nearly 2,000 capsules are stored underwater at Hanford's waste encapsulation and storage facility, which has been operated almost a decade longer than it was designed to last.
We're extending design life in the nuclear world. Isn't that wonderful?
It is the DOE facility that is at greatest risk in the case of a natural disaster beyond what it was designed to sustain, according to a memo by the Department of Energy's Office of Inspector General. A severe earthquake could result in the loss of power or water in the pool. The memo was publicly released this week. The memo also noted that an earthquake or other disaster more severe than the facility was designed for is, quote, extremely improbable.
So make your bets now.
Mm-hmm. Japan's Fuk nuclear disaster is unlikely to lead to a rise in the number of people developing cancer as after Chernobyl, even though the most exposed children may face an increased risk, according to UN scientists. In a major study, the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, UNSCEAR, said it did not expect significant changes in future cancer rates that could be attributed to radiation exposure from the reactor meltdowns.
That's in the good news file.
It is. Yeah. Made an Adam smile today. The Air Force announced Thursday it has relieved nine mid-level commanders assigned to safeguard the nation's nuclear arsenal following a wide-ranging probe into a test-cheating scandal that implicated scores of airmen. The dismissed officers, most of whom were colonels and lieutenant colonels, were not found to have facilitated or condoned cheating at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, but they were held accountable for creating a culture that enabled it.
Serves them right for creating a culture.
The scandal, which came to light after a probe into suspected drug use among missileers at Malmstrom, has been among the most embarrassing ethical lapses the Pentagon has had to contend with.
Aside from concocting the word missileers.
Yeah, that's pretty embarrassing, too. And river herring is the collective term for two very similar fish species, alewife and blueback herring. Their abundance throughout Massachusetts has declined to historically low levels.
Why are you telling us this?
I'll tell you in a minute. As a result of these declines, the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries established a three-year moratorium in 2005 on the sale and harvest of them. The moratorium has been extended. The depletion of river herring led to rules on the taking of the fish. Under Massachusetts law, whoever takes, kills, or hauls on shore or disturbs, injures, hinders, or obstructs the passage of any herring, alewives, or other swimming marine food fish without its permission, the city or town, contrary to its regulation, shall be punished by a fine, $50 per fish. Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant in Massachusetts continues to impinge and kill large numbers of river herring on the screens of their cooling water intake structure. An average of 2,481 river herring per year, and have been known to impinge on as many as 41,000 for decades. At $50 a fish, quite a financial fine, yet the take at Pilgrim is essentially unregulated.
It's a free market in fish.
Clean, cheap, safe. Too clean to meter, too clean to fine.
You're thinking about it?
I am indeed. It is our friend, the Atom.
My heart, it is broken. For I loved you so dearly. You're my Romany Chavo, my dear gypsy boy. But the life that we shared, it was gone in a moment. And with it all pleasure, oh, and with it all joy. You rode a horse like a king, and you sang like an angel. But it brought you no peace by night or by day. For when sunlight burns cruel and moonlight shines baleful, well, there's nowhere to go and no reason to stay. Like a king, and I watched you so proudly with my heart in my mouth, afraid you might fall. And when the fall came, there was no one could catch you, there was no one could help you. No one. They grow strong from such sadness, grown from the grave of a lost gypsy child. And the leaves and the long grass, they whisper your name, my Romany Chavo, so dear and so wild. One day I'll hear hoofbeats and not grieve for the rider. And the song that you sang will bring peace and not pain. And the fields where you rode on your own cushy dry will bloom with the promise of laughter again. One day I'll hear hoofbeats and not grieve for the rider. And the song that you sang will bring peace and not pain. And the fields where you rode on your own cushy gry will bloom with the promise of laughter.
This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. The yearly audit of U.S. Catholic diocese compliance with national measures to report and prevent clergy sexual abuse has found a decline in the number of reported cases of abuse from July 2012 to June 2013. But it also cited concerns about the limited scope of the auditor's abilities. A particular concern are four dioceses that would not allow any audits to take place. And the fact that most dioceses do not allow or conduct audits of parishes or schools where most reporting of abuse is thought to occur, the auditors write. You see, during the finding period, 857 survivors of clergy sexual abuse reported 936 allegations of abuse in 191 dioceses, the audit reports. A decline from the 921 survivors who reported abuse in the previous audit period. But, yes, the Bishops' Conference is mandated to conduct the audit under their Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People, adopted in 2002 following explosive press coverage of clergy sexual abuse cases. Bishops, while strongly encouraged to participate, cannot be required to do so. That limitation is mentioned several times by the auditors. The Diocese of Lincoln, Nebraska, continues to be the only U.S. diocese that refuses to allow any auditing. Three eparchies, the archdioceses of Eastern Rite Catholic Church, has also refused auditing. The reports don't mention the two clergy sexual abuse cases that garnered the most attention in the last year in St. Paul, where an archdiocesan chancellor resigned, saying allegations went unreported, and in Newark, where an archdiocesan priest was arrested in May for maintaining contact with children despite a court agreement not to do so. In their report, the auditors cite four major limitations to the scope of their studies: lack of auditing at the parish level, inconsistent methods for collecting statistics, turnover in positions at diocesan offices, and the refusal of four dioceses and eparchies to participate at all. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. We'll just walk away quietly from that. You may be aware that two big events occurred this week in the lives of, respectively, George H.W. and George W. Bush. George H.W. Bush, there was a celebration at College Station, Texas, home of Texas A&M, home of the Aggies, of the 25th anniversary of the George H.W. Bush administration. Not of the exact date of its beginning. That would have been January 20th, but, you know, close enough. And then down in over in Dallas at the Bush Presidential Library, there was the opening of an exhibition of paintings by George W. Bush, who basically has painted so far, aside from himself, the famous painting of himself in a bathtub, which he's a little ticked off that got leaked. So, pardon the thing. But he painted mainly world leaders, including Tony Blair and Vladimir Putin, as he explained to his daughter, who now works for NBC.
I hope he likes it. I like it. I like it because it conveys a compassionate person and a strong person and a reliable friend. Vladimir Putin, yeah. Vladimir is a person who, in many ways, views the U.S. as an enemy. And although he wouldn't say that, I felt that he viewed the world as either the U.S. benefits and Russia loses or vice versa. Mm-hmm. I tried, of course, to dispel him of that notion.
Yeah, because it's not, you know, you're either with us or against us. That would be, who would think that way? The first reference was to Tony Blair and the second, of course, to Vladimir Putin. So it just occurred to me maybe to tap a phone line and see if the two of them might be chatting.
Breaststroke Eagle. Hey, 43, you out? Oh, heck yeah, 41. I've been up for a couple hours. Wanted to paint the mailbox, waiting for mail. You know, it conveys such a mood of yearnfulness. Okay. Well, didn't want to wake up Laura. She's been up since sunrise. She wanted to paint the sunrise? Oh, heck no. No, she wanted to watch the new gal on Good Morning America. No, she doesn't paint. Shoot. She merely cleans. So, how come you're calling? You're just down the hall. Well, as I say, didn't want to wake up anybody. Well, the phone rings about the loudest thing in this room, except the toilet. That thing is loud, and there's something wrong with the plumbing doohickey because it just sprays your butt with water every time you get up. Mm-hmm. And it's always been kind of not the easier thing in the world for us to talk man-to-man. Face-to-face. Well, at least if you talk to my face, it's not soaking wet from that busted toilet. It's probably a bidet. You know what, 41? I could give a rat's behind who made it. I just like it to work. Sure. So, thought I'd call, say kind of thank you for coming up here and speaking at this anniversary thing. Oh, hey, the coming up was no problem. Secret Service guy loves to take that limo out on the open road. Says it helps clean out the car's berator. And as for the speaking, 41, you know, I don't much like to do away with words, but I know it. That's why we helped pay for the writer, who did a great job, by the way. Was that one of your old White House people? Matter of fact, he's white, he's not that old, not that I care about either of those things, because I don't see age, I don't see color.
No,
I meant, well, anyway, lovely remarks. Well, sir, every word of it was meant to be said. Did Mom like it? She'd gone out to get some Pepto just before you came on. Uh-huh. Well, listen, 41, while I got you on the phone here, I was meaning to ask you, you know, we're opening my little art exhibition down at the library.
Gotta be honest with you, Sprout. That's a sentence never thought I'd hear you say.
Yeah, well, there are probably lots of those, including the oath of office. Well, but that's all Bridgewater under the dam. Look, 41, I painted Putin. I painted Tony Blair.
No, you pray with him before or after he posed.
He didn't pose. I painted him from memory and an old Newsweek cover. I painted a lot of world leaders, and I was just wondering
if I have any old Newsweeks lying around. No, Don't think we do, Barbara. Sold a bunch to the Salvation Army.
No. Just wondering if you'd mind or if you'd even like if I painted one of my predecessors.
Huh?
One who's celebrating a certain anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
One who might get a little cross if I painted him without asking his permission.
Yeah. Well, know what you mean.
Yeah.
Carter can be so touchy about stuff. What got on his wrong side at a reception down at the Carter Center when I told him just to be friendly that he was looking younger than Rosalind? He turned all frosty on me.
41, I'm asking if you mind if I painted you.
Oh. Oh. Well, D-43, suppose I'd be flattered if you hadn't gone through the entire membership of the G-20 before getting to me. But seriously, you've got more important people to paint. You've done Dick Cheney yet?
No, my art coach says I'm not ready yet to tackle stuff with actual emotional content to it. I mean, you'd be the first.
Uh-huh.
But it'd just be the good emotional content.
Yeah.
Not that there is any other, or not for that matter.
Sure. Well, have you checked it out with Barbara? Sure, she'd have an opinion on it. She's kind of the head of the emotional department of this family.
Mm-hmm. Well, sir, I just thought we could handle this, you know, mango a mango.
Uh-huh.
And being that this is the anniversary of your administration and we're all feeling celebratorially, I thought maybe I could, come over and just do a little preliminary sketch work before you have to take off.
Well,
no brushes or anything, just a number two pencil.
Hmm. Isn't that a little dark?
Could do it with a number one, sure.
Yeah. Don't see that there's anything wrong with it. Does it mean I'd have to sit here stock still like a mannequin? Sat for my White House portrait and ended up stiffer than a sailor on a bender.
Yeah, sort of difficult to catch the nuances when you're on the move there.
Yeah, sure. Understand, but maybe you should tackle Cheney first. Or Rumsfeld. He's got a good face to paint, that smile and everything.
Yeah, that'd be a neat challenge, painting teeth. All my subjects so far have had their mouths closed. That's why I thought...
Well, like I say, Sprout, just very grateful for the kind words at the function today. Made me feel as if maybe the old man wasn't such a bad dad and a bad president after all.
Oh, no way were you a bad president, 41. You were one of the best. And hey, we may have another one in the family yet if donors keep busting Jeb's door down.
Well, you got to get somebody who's both a grown-up and not under investigation, don't they?
Hey, 43, don't want to keep you. Give our love to Laura. Give mine to Mom.
Oh, she knows you love her. She instilled that in you. Take care, 43. You too, 41.
And now, news from outside the bubble. If people in Crimea were still wondering how much life might change following the Russian takeover of the peninsula, they now have an answer. No more McDonald's. The fast food chain has announced it's closing its outlets in Crimea's main cities, Simferopol, Sevastopol, and Yalta, due to what a statement on the McDonald's Ukraine website referred to only as, quote, manufacturing reasons, unquote. The company said work at the outlets was merely suspended and had hoped to reopen them, but staff at the restaurants will be offered the chance to relocate permanently to Ukraine. That's from the Observer, from The Guardian, sorry. This from The Age in Australia. Vanity and our vulnerability to the power of advertising are changing consumer habits from breakfast to bedtime and contributing to a major environmental mess thanks to microbeads, minute bits of plastic that have been inserted in everyday products from facial creams to toothpaste, touted in advertising as a healthy advance, but they are turbocharging an already dire problem, the global pollution of oceans, lakes, and rivers by discarded plastic. What makes microbeads especially threatening is they enter the environment already broken down into all but invisible microplastics. Tiny and buoyant, going down our drains, not filtered by sewage systems, they're swiftly ingestible by marine life, making them more immediately dangerous than a discarded drink bottle. They're likely to have entered the food chain, so while you wouldn't eat your facial scrub, you might be consuming it if you eat fish. And for what benefits? Almost none, according to Associate Professor Greg Goodman of the Australian College of Dermatologists. Our modern obsession with scrubbing skin is for most people doing more harm than good. People are exfoliating everything, he says, but we're not floorboards. We don't need to be polishing and buffing and scrubbing. Most scientists, dermatologists don't like exfoliation because the barrier functions of the skin get exfoliated, and that's a negative thing for your skin. The use of microbeads in cosmetics is recent. Most patents date only to the middle of the last decade, but there's already a backlash against the harm they're doing. Significant microbead pollution has already been discovered in the Great Lakes region of the United States. Microbeads, ladies and gentlemen. There's always something. We know from a food source point of view that the smaller the plastic, the more harm it does. This is according to Dr. Eric von Sibiel of the Climate Change Research Center at the University of New South Wales. By suspicion, he says, with something like microbeads, is the harm is done right where our sewage systems hit the ocean. Major cosmetics manufacturers say they're going to phase out the use of microbeads over the next 3 to 5 years. For consumers, Dr. Goodman, the dermatologist, says there's an easier, quicker solution. Use something natural. Quote, we mix up the squeaky feel of skin as being something healthy, and it's really not. It's actually impending dry, terrible skin. They're not understanding what healthy skin is, he says, talking about us. And from the Independent here in England, supermarkets and food retailers today are accused of failing to take responsibility for the UK's food waste crisis, contributing to 15 million tons of produce being thrown away unnecessarily every year. A report published by the House of Lords Committee, they have lords here, concludes British retailers are shifting the blame onto consumers by luring them in with buy one, get one free offers, which lead to the consumers buying stuff that they then throw away. Farmers are also unfairly scapegoated by supermarkets, which often tie farmers to contracts with specific market chains and then cancel orders in the last minute. This is while we're being told that impending climate change will possibly result in problems feeding people. 20 to 40% of crops, fruits and vegetables in the United Kingdom are never harvested as they do not comply with strict cosmetic specifications by retailers. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, it's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, the apology of the week.
We're so sorry.
Again, some news of the godly, responding to critics and citing, quote, the phenomenon we've come to know as Pope Francis, unquote. The Archbishop of Atlanta apologized this week for a plan to build a new $2.2 million home for himself, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Archbishop Wilton Gregory moved out of his old residence earlier this year and into a new house in the Buckhead neighborhood of Atlanta. The house was built with money left over by Joseph Mitchell, the nephew of the author of Gone with the Wind. The Atlanta newspaper published a story about the building plans last month. In the last week, the Archbishop wrote he's received numerous heartfelt, genuine, and candidly rebuking letters, emails, and telephone messages. To all of you, I apologize sincerely and from my heart. We didn't stop to consider, and that oversight rests with me and me alone, he said. Was that the world and the church have changed. We, the bishops of the church, were reminded by our own failings and frailty that we're called to live more simply, more humbly. He isn't the first Catholic figure to recently face criticism for the cost of his home. Newark, New Jersey Archbishop John Myers recently came under fire for a plan to build a $500,000 addition to his retirement home. Pope Francis has urged priests to avoid luxurious lifestyles and instead buy fancy suits. No, sorry, he didn't say that. An Air Canada executive, specifically, has apologized personally to famed violinist Itzhak Perlman after the disabled musician said one of the airline's employees refused to help him at Pearson International Airport. That would be, I believe, in Montreal. Perlman's agent said the musician's assistant received an email from Marc-André Haute, Air Canada's director of VIP and global concierge services, who extended a personal apology and asked to coordinate a time to speak with Perlman directly. It's interesting that there are so many people out there who are so supportive of Mr. Perlman and have a lot of empathy for what he went through, said his agent. There have been so many achievements helping the disabled, but there's still a ways to go, and Monday really highlighted that, he said. You see it. He said he received a voicemail from an Air Canada spokesperson reassuring him the company takes the allegations very seriously and is conducting an internal review. Perlman told the Montreal Star he was abandoned by an Air Canada employee somewhere between his arrival gate and passport control with his violin, crutches, and luggage. He had been in town for a charity concert. The agent said he has not yet spoken to Perlman about Air Canada's apology. Dozens of people left comments on his Facebook page to apologize for the way he was treated and to share stories about poor customer service from airlines. Really? That's happened to other... Dateline New York Fox News' Bill Hemmer apologized for their inaccurate graphic depicting healthcare signups after people started criticizing the network for misleading information. Fox News was covering the deadline for people to sign up for healthcare exchanges when they showed 6 million signups on March 27 and then a significant gap to the goal of 7 million on April 1st. The network was slammed for falsely presenting the facts about the healthcare signup progress. They quickly showed a more accurate graphic than host Bill Hemmer. Hemmed, he couldn't haw, he's a hemmer, apologized while displaying the corrected graphic. Here was what that graphic should have looked like, Hemmer said. That was our mistake. Correction noted. Radio personality Brian B. McLaughlin apologized this week to an openly gay Winston-Salem State University student whom he had criticized last week in a string of slur-filled posts on Twitter. McLaughlin wrote in the tweets, which appear to have been deleted, that Aaron McCorkle shouldn't be elected Mr. WSSU, Winston-Salem State University, because pictures posted online showed McCorkle wearing women's clothing. Quote, I'd like to publicly express my sincerest apologies to Mr. WSSU Royal Court candidate Aaron McCorkle, his family, and his friends for the offensive and unprofessional tweets that I publicly posted, McLaughlin said in a statement released through his publicist, Casey Adams. The school announced the winner of Mr. WSSU. McCorkle lost. He couldn't be reached for comments. McLaughlin was the public address announcer for the school's football and basketball games and is a morning radio host for 102 Jams. In the tweets, McLaughlin said he would resign if McCorkle was elected Mr. WSSU, the school's equivalent of a homecoming queen, a king, and he used numerous racial and gay slurs in the tweets. I was wrong, and I know my comments hurt not only Aaron, his family and friends, but others as well, McLaughlin said. And here's former football star, now sports talk radio host Boomer Esiason, who criticized a New York Mets player this week.
I want to say again on this radio show that in no way, shape, or form was I advocating anything for anybody to do. Was not telling women what to do with their bodies or anything like that. I will never do that. That's their decisions. That's their life, and they know their bodies better than I do. And the other thing too that I really felt bad about is that Daniel Murphy and Tori Murphy were dragged into a conversation, and their whole life was exposed, and it shouldn't have been. And that is my fault. That is my fault for uttering the word C-section on this radio station. And it all of a sudden put their lives under a spotlight. And for that, I truly apologize. I tried to reach out to Daniel yesterday through intermediaries over there at the New York Mets. And to his credit, he answered all of his questions yesterday. I'm sorry that he had to go through that. No man should have to go through that. And all I could say is that I truly, truly feel terrible about what I put them through. So for that, I certainly apologize. And again, like I said, I apologize for putting him and his wife in the midst of a public discussion that I basically started by uttering insensitive comments that came off very insensitive. So for that, I apologize, and that's really all I can do. And I can only hope that people understand that my comment, my flippant comment, wasn't meant in any way, shape, or form to insult anybody, but it obviously did. And for that, I am truly sorry.
Yeah, he's got a lot of time to fill, doesn't he? And finally, a weather spotter's training class, which was to be held at the Tilton Public Works building, I believe in Pittsburgh, on Thursday, has been canceled due to the weather. Yes, a weather spotter's training class was canceled due to the weather. Officials apologize for the inconvenience. The Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, a tip of the show, chapeau to my friend, bass player Danny Thompson, who this week celebrated his 75th birthday with a week full of concerts. He must like to play that thing. That concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet. 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Available via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it. HarryShearer.com and KCSN.org. Available for your smartphone via Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast at WWNO.org. SoundCloud.com. Sideshow Network, and iTunes. Free, I think. And it'd be just like another 75 for Danny if you'd agree to be with me here, then would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Show chapeau also to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Jenny Lawson at WWNO in New Orleans. And thanks to Adrian Bottom here at Global Radio in London with help for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this program, playlist of the music heard here on, and a fabulous store with Cars I Talk t-shirts all sitting there waiting for you at HarryShearer.com. And I'm sitting there yakking at you via Twitter, at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from London.